Guys, Evangeline's hearing voices and Danvers is semi-pissed all the time.
Time is a flat circle, I guess.
What other wisdom do you have to give us, Adam, after your disappearance into the ice?
But what they see are these bones in the shape of a swirl. What do you think they were the bones of?
Maybe a solid narrative structure?
I'm going to get the justice women on you.
This podcast was recorded remotely
and may contain adult language and themes.
Hello and welcome to TV DNA, True Detective, Night Country, the finale. My name is Adam Hemming, and because it's the last episode of the series, we've gathered the whole gang together. I have been joined by Neil Sheppard.
I'll just fix this. I need to do this one thing and then I'll be here with you.
Oh, lovely. Well, yeah, take your time, Neil. Also with us is Damien Cooper.
Time is a flat circle, I guess.
And really joining us for the finale is Grace Chapman.
Oh, it's going to be one of those nights, isn't it?
I certainly expect so, given the last episode and the WhatsApp emoji sent by Mr. Cooper. Let's dive in, though. Grace, did the finale stick the landing for you?
Just about. It teetered on that landing. It was swinging wildly all over the place, but then I think it got there for me personally. Episodes 4 and 5 for me were a bit lacking. I felt like we were just charging through the plot. The dialogue was just serving the plot. But then this last episode, it felt like we were back to the really good writing. And I have to say, Jodie Foster and Callie Rice, absolutely brilliant in this episode. Couldn't fault their performance. I'm, what should we say, enthusiastic Emma?
And Neil, do you think we asked the right questions and did we get them answered?
Definitely think we asked the right questions. Because we chose them. But I think as far as getting the answers, I can't remember the questions. I think we got a lot of answers in this final episode.
Great, excellent. So that's initial opinions done then. Shall we move on to... All right then, Damo. Damo, tell us what you thought of the finale.
I genuinely lost count the number of times I shouted at the TV screen, "Oh, fuck off."
Shocking.
What did your neighbours think?
I did it daytime, so I didn't break any common decency noise laws.
Were you watershed?
Indeed. And I live in a nice neighbourhood, so there's probably a couple of old grannies absolutely scandalised by the streaming of effing and jeffing that came out of my living room. I really, really wanted to like it. I didn't enjoy the pacing. I feel like they flirted with the supernatural, but it never really happened. I think
you didn't want it to happen, though.
But my point is, why bother? There was so much of the show was like, why bother? Why did you waste our time with that? Things were put up and then weren't explored. I think one of the best things about season one of True Detective was proper conversations. We had a couple of them in this episode, and I echo what you said, Grace. I think our two leads were brilliant in it. Probably the only reason why I watched to the end, because I thought both their performances were excellent. But I mean, even with the twist at the end, how they did it, it just felt almost saccharine. And the kind of internal logic of their reaction to that as a detective just doesn't really make sense because it means the mind's won anyway.
Wait, there was a twist at the end?
I don't think the mind's won anyway because the video was, the Clark's video was leaked, wasn't it? So that information was put out there. And I think looking back on the whole show, right, the supernatural stuff is really about how the dead live on with us, right? And it was how people dealt with the dead and in a way, in a comforting way at times, but in other times, sort of a fairly horrific way. You know, the dead sort of, and the older you get, as Rose said, the older you get, sort of the closer you are to those dead people. Maybe Rose didn't say that. Maybe I made that up or heard it in an interview with Jodie Foster. But definitely that's kind of the sense that I got from the show was that actually a lot of the supernatural stuff, and it was all explained away in a perfectly logical way, I think. A lot of that supernatural stuff really was about reaction to or connection to those who had been lost.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think the last sort of 20 minutes of the show really solidified that. I feel like this show is just about grief, really. And as you said, sort of Adam, maybe the closer that we get to death, the more that we become connected to that realm in some form. And also that they never really leave. And then that kind of veil is very thin at times. And I personally really liked all that. I thought that was actually some of the best bits of the final episode, is when they kind of, maybe it was laid on a little thick at times, but I genuinely found that all quite moving at the end. Genuinely though, guys, what twist?
The butler did it.
Eh?
Effectively, the butler did it, right? It was the cleaners and the domestics and the sort of people in the background were the ones who had driven the scientists out into the ice.
Yeah. No, I do. Yeah, I get you now. Yeah. I love those women. More of them. That's actually something that we could have done with more of, maybe. Damo, what do you think about that? Maybe they should have been threaded through a little better?
They're in the background of every episode, these women.
Yeah, I just wanted to check. Were you saying you wanted more female characters in this show?
Damo, always.
I did listen to an interview with Jodie Foster, and she describes those women as the Justice Ladies, which I quite liked. Anyway, let's dive in, shall we? So, we open with Jodie and Callie, or Liz and Evangeline, digging in the ice. They've got no equipment at all for getting through these caves. They've got no backup. Break their way through and enter this perfectly formed cave. but the shivers and, yeah, it's all a bit spooky.
Okay, so point number one here. They live in Innes. They've not just turned up. They're not 3 days into being there. They know where they're going is dangerous. Why do they not have anything at all? They don't have a ladder. They don't have anything that they could possibly use to get back out of that cave. She just drops down and it's ice. How are they getting back out? Unless by chance they fall through the ice again and then find themselves mere yards from the Tsalal scientific station.
Yeah, you would have thought some rope and some crampons, right? At the very least.
I've been ice caving. You need crampons. You can't not do it.
Look, guys, Evangeline's hearing voices and Danvers is semi-pissed all the time.
I did write, one of my notes was, is Evangeline a Jedi? Because I thought that could have been a good explanation for it all. So it did make me jump when she fell through the ice. I thought it was a good shock moment that when she fell through the ice. And then when Liz falls through, it's just brilliant comedy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so point number two. Obviously, Evangeline falls on a bum. All right. So she might be slightly uncomfortable, but she's fallen in the best possible place. Danvers has fallen 15 feet, maybe more, chest rib first into the ice. And she kind of goes, oh, that's a bit sore. But she's up and walking around like it's not. She just dusts it off like it's nothing.
And what she goes through later, what she survives later on. I mean, if you're worried about her falling that distance and surviving, I'm going with a padded coat.
I just wanted to also, at the end of season one of True Detective, don't they end up in some caves?
Yeah, some weird, I mean, it's been a while since I've seen that final episode of season one. But yeah, they end up going through some kind of cave system, and then I think they then find themselves above ground at the end.
I wondered if that was a little nod.
Another Easter egg that doesn't go anywhere.
So Navarro sees Clark, and the first of our questions gets answered, right? Where is Clark? We now know he's in the ice cave.
How lucky, by the way, how lucky that just by chance, Evangeline flashes a torch in one direction and sees him and he runs away. That's so fortunate because, I mean, oh, what are the chances?
Ah, Clark was definitely the kind of guy to stalk them around that ice cave. He knew they were there and he was going to check they got out.
Yeah, that ice cave wasn't necessarily that big. I mean, he would absolutely pick up on a presence there. And he's probably quite lonely and wanting to meet some friends.
He's been down there a while, right? But what they see in the ceiling of the ice cave are these bones in the shape of a swirl. What do you think they were the bones of?
It looked a bit like some sort of sea animal, like an eel or something like that.
Maybe a solid narrative structure?
Hey, Mo, I'm going to get the Justice Women on you.
Yeah.
The Justice Ladies. So we get that. We then get the credits, and at the end of the credits, we get a broken hubcap, which plays into the episode later on. And then they then discover, when they find the lab that Clark has run off and led them to, they discover the star-shaped tool that was used to make wounds on Annie Kay. Now, we already suspected this was where she was killed. They find a ladder behind some shelves, and that leads up to Salal. And Twist and Shout is playing faintly in the background again.
I mean, has that been on the whole time?
Well, here's my time as a flat circle theory, right? Because I thought she utterly destroyed all of that equipment in the first episode.
Yeah.
So either Clark's been back up there and fixed it, or it's a time loop.
If I may quote the great Adam Hemming, it's fine.
It's fine?
That's what you said when we talked about one of the previous episodes where something absolute bullshit happened and you were like, it's fine.
No, I don't. I think it's fascinating that the Twisted Shout is playing again, because I'm convinced she destroyed all of that equipment. So I think there is some sort of weird time loop going on.
I think that she just managed to stop it without destroying it. I think she pulled it out. So that means a plug or a cable became dislodged rather than the absolute smash that she gives it in this episode 6. This was probably one of my biggest old fuck-offs, was that suddenly they were in the Salal research facility, so they hadn't traveled a big distance and somehow they were there. How did they not know, or how did that not come up in conversation, that they were so close to the research facility? Because obviously it's the big kind of, you know, if you're going to geolocate where you are in the tundra, that's a pretty significant place.
I have to say, I agree with Damo on this one. That made geographically zero sense.
Damo, I've got a question. How many fuck-offs are left?
Oh, get comfortable, Neil. We've got double figures at least.
Maybe geographical space is a flat circle as well. Anyway, we get a little shot of Pete cleaning in his pants, which we all enjoyed. And then Navarro and Liz are working their way through Salal's station. We see the delivery that arrived in the first episode. We get a shot of that. And then we get some wet footprints. And then there's this very, very much short-lived jeopardy where Clark locks Danvers in/out of this in this place, and then knocks Navarro out with a fire extinguisher. But quite quickly, Navarro wakes up and Liz breaks out.
This had big "I know you did" last summer energy about it. Like I was saying, this season one is like a really taut psychological, philosophical horror. This is like your classic popcorn shock horror, this series, I think, in comparison.
I'd have to agree.
Yeah, I mean, this for me was quite a quick turnaround from danger, peril to, oh, no, we're all okay now. It's good. Move on.
Maybe this episode didn't need to be an hour and a half long. You could have lost 5 minutes there.
Maybe this series didn't have to be 6 episodes long. Maybe we could have just had it as a one-off episode.
Anyway, let's not beat up too much, because there was some really, really brilliant stuff in this. So Navarro beats up Clark. That we learn at that point, I think, there's no Wi-Fi, no radio, the storm. They're stuck there, basically. They're going to be there for a good chunk of this episode, certainly. We get a scene with Leah and Pete. He's noticed a tooth in the wall, which I quite enjoyed.
I was just going to say, is that a tooth in the wall? How did a tooth end up in the wall?
Well, when you shoot someone in the head.
I guess, little ricochet.
Listeners, there was a lovely mime from Damo there as a gun pointed at his head and then a tooth shot out the other side. Anyway, he kind of persuades Leah to go back to Kayla's. We don't need to dwell on that, I don't think. There's loads to cover here. Navarro asks, did you love Annie? He says, yes. And then she tapes the headphones to his head, making him listen to her screams on repeat, before Liz just turns around and says, want some coffee?
I thought that was perfect torture. I thought that was a really good part of this episode.
It's on a loop, motherfucker.
Now, my question here is from a policing point of view here.
Are you a policeman, Damo?
Well, if anyone can answer this question, it would be useful. I do spend a lot of time working with the police. But at this point, they're not definitely sure that he has had anything to do with her death. And so they've not got evidence. They know that he knows stuff, but they don't know that he's killed her. And that feels not necessarily the best way of going around, by torturing someone. If we think it's not okay to torture people, then I think we have to extend that to this, right?
He has just locked Liz into this frozen place and knocked Navarro out with a fire extinguisher.
And Damo, as you've worked a lot with the police, what would be the best way of policing the situation?
Well, I think certainly, as most police people are told, you have to at least build some level of rapport, and that is an anti-rapport.
I just want to talk about Callie Rice at this point, because she was really starting to build on her A game. I thought just the way that she looked at him, she hated him. And she didn't just hate him, she hated all men. And you could see it, all men who do bad things to women, I should caveat. And I from this point on, I started not to be able to take my eyes off her when she was in a scene. I just thought she was really fantastic. And I feel like she'd been kind of building to this the whole series. And here we were. And I loved it. From this moment on, I was just totally loved her performance.
Let's move on, though, because we get a scene with Kayla and Pete. She knows something is up. He says, as Neil said earlier, I need to do this one thing and then I'll be here with you. She kisses him. And once again, I was convinced he was going to die.
So this was my fuck off moment. What? This scene was daft. Let's call it what it was. Like, it was a bit daft. Like, why does she suddenly love him because he's got to go do a thing?
Yeah, there was a very loud fuck off at this bit as well. It made no sense. That whole storyline was just so torturous and unnecessary throughout anyway. It was tropey as fuck. We get it. It's difficult working in the police. It takes up your whole life, etc., etc. But yeah, I agree. This whole idea of, oh yeah, just believe me and it will be okay after I do this one major thing. Oh yeah, fine. I won't question it, even though I've kicked you out 2 days ago. It's okay.
Meanwhile, back at Salal, an orange rolls out of the fridge.
Ooh, not for the first time.
No, but and then we learn that Grandma used to love them and Julia too. So not only do they represent death, but they represent specific people to Navarro.
I know we talked about previously about the opening credits. So oranges appear twice in those opening credits. Once as an orange unpeeled, and then we see either it's the orange peel or the orange falling out of it having been peeled in those opening credits.
And then is this where we also get a bit of a shot of someone walking on broken glass? And then Danvers says, it's crazy the shit we survive. Is this point?
Annie Lennox. Yes, we do get the... it's Liz, basically. It's a memory. She pulls a piece of glass out of her shoe, which she's broken through that glass door to get out from where Clark had locked her in. Bit of glass in her shoe, and that causes a little flashback for her to remember walking on glass previously. And then we later see... Navarro talks about the fact that her grandma could, or Julia could, peel an orange in one go, right? And then Liz is trying to do that later on, and she doesn't quite make it. But when she leaves the orange peel that she makes, it forms the swirl shape that we know and love.
Is this also around the time that Liz looks under the table where previously the tongue had been found, and there's something happens? We get kind of like a moisture or a glue or something is on the floor in the shape of where that tongue was.
Yeah, I thought it was an ice deposit, like the tongue had been frozen somehow. I think this is the only question we don't really get answered, right? Was who cut her tongue out and why?
I think potentially that is directly answered in that they mentioned that a cop came back, and my suspicion, I can't remember the character's name, but Christopher Eccleston's character probably hid what was going on by doing that.
I think, do they not say that the mine people take it? So they don't know how to get rid of the body. It goes to the mine people, and then the mine people give it to the cop. And the fact is, irregardless, I think it's that kind of symbolic thing of they wanted to silence her. That's why her tongue was cut out, right?
Yeah. Speaking of tongues, we then get a questioning of Clark. We learn that he wasn't there at first when she was killed. We learn what she found out. This is our second question answered of the episode. She found out scribbles, but basically she worked out what they were doing. They were digging for the DNA that could potentially save the world. And they'd cracked it. They'd done it. They'd got it from this stuff. And the reason they'd been able to do that was because the pollution from the mine helped soften the permafrost. So they weren't just covering up the pollution statistics. They were pushing the mine to produce more pollutants.
We're saying yay, global warming.
No, that is what we, or I think they are saying either. I think it was a very convenient excuse for what they did. And it does bring up a very large question that we certainly can't answer now as to whether you make sacrifices for the global benefit.
I think in terms of the story, it puts the scientists as the big bads and lets take Kittrick off the hook a little bit.
Well, yeah, it basically says we've got to think about the greater good. Science would make life better for everyone. And yeah, I guess we have to poison these people in this town that no one will ever really care about. Sadly, they're in the way of progress.
As an environmentalist, it is a big thing and a big argument, but it's like, I don't know, it's almost like scientists telling us that we all have to change our habits and change the way that we live for the sake of future survival as a species. That's what I kind of related it to. They were trying to save the Earth. And do you kill to achieve that? If you don't kill, the result is that, you know, the species doesn't survive.
I feel like the series message was that you shouldn't do that, because if you do, you're going to be thrust out in the icy snow and naked.
Yeah, that's not nice.
So we learn the scientists were the ones who killed Annie, right? So Lund starts it off, but they all pitch in. And if you've done all of that research and all of that work, and you potentially found something that's going to cure diseases and all the rest of it, and then this girl comes along and destroys all of that work, you might have an extreme reaction.
I had a question at that point about whether Annie genuinely died or not. I mean, obviously she did at some point, but, you know, that whole kind of question of supernatural or natural, you know, she survived the first attempt to kill her, which led to that, what's almost a catchphrase for this series, she's alive. And yeah, what point did she actually die?
We see Clark goes to her, realizing that basically she's going to die, and she's fighting and struggling, and he just smothers her to try and put her out of her misery. We see the bloody hands move on, so he literally has her blood on his hands, on his chest, on his face, and so she definitely dies then and there.
Does he succeed? We don't actually see that.
As I said, the arms flop down. She stops fighting.
And we know her body's discovered by Navarro in the timeline. But yeah, again, we get the unreliable narrator, right? He's telling Navarro and Danvers what happened, and we're seeing that it was him that ultimately killed her. And that's our third question answered. And at this point, Neil, if no more questions get answered, you get a point.
Yay!
We've got quite a long way to go.
What do you get? When do you get a half point?
Never. No half points in this game. He thinks that cutting out the tongue was Hank doing it as to send a warning. So we do get some explanation for that. So yeah, I was wrong about that earlier. Anyway, Liz walks out as Navarro pulls a gun on Clark. She says, not going to stop me. And Liz says, no. And then we get the flashback to Wheeler and the whistling of Twist and Shout again. And later we find out that it was Navarro that shot Wheeler. And that's the fourth question answered. So very quickly, Neil, you're out of the points. Damo's into the points. But again, we've still got a long way to go here.
Was anyone genuinely shocked that it was Navarro that had killed him?
No.
Not really. Though there was like 10% of me that was like, could it have been Danvers still? So yeah, I was, you know, I was toying with the idea and I liked the finality of it.
That point, and obviously we find out different, but when Navarro whether she allows or whether she forces Clark to get frozen in the ice, and obviously so similar to the scientist's demise, I wondered whether she had done the same thing with the scientists. Obviously, we find out later on that that's not the case, but that was what was going through my head at that point.
Just quickly going back on the Wheeler scene, they're after the gunshot, they hear a baby crying. And my question was, is that Holden?
That's what I thought. I thought that's got to be Holden. There was never, they never confirmed it, but I just thought, surely that's got to be how that happened.
The reason why I don't think it's Holden is because the two people in the Wheeler case are white.
Oh.
Whereas Holden, when we see him, is dual heritage. So he can't be him. I think that Holden is What's her face's younger brother, right?
Possibly, yeah. Could well be. Okay, well, let's move on. So they also questioned Clark about what happened to the other scientists, and he says it was Annie. He basically ran off and hid in a hatch to hide. There was all these rattling noises from above, and Danvers says he was right there the whole time we were searching underneath this hatch. This is where we get the, she's been hiding in those caves forever. Time is a flat circle and we are all stuck in it, whatever that means. But he's basically begging Navarro to kill him or let him commit suicide himself. And he's done. And obviously later on, as you said, Neil, we find him stuck in the ice. There's a weird scene of Liz finding a cross in her hair.
Yeah. Now, we've seen that cross somewhere before and I couldn't remember where. Anyone remember?
It was on a dead body under a bed that Navarro saw.
Right. So that's helpful in no way.
I think what it's signifying is that Danvers is starting to have these weird supernatural experiences as well. Yeah. The tongue is the first one, and that can maybe be explained. And then obviously she finds this crucifix in her hair. I wondered initially if she was wearing it and decided to have taken it off as she was going to go and sleep. But it all seemed a bit weird. It felt like they were like, let's put that in as well, but we're not going to really do anything about it.
Yeah, it kind of felt to me like the, let's say, unreal or non-naturalistic moments where both Danvers and Navarro kind of find themselves in another world of a kind, with Navarro's like a kind of desert. With Navarro, I guess it's more kind of connection with memories. My big question is, Annie, are you okay? Are you okay, Annie?
Well, yeah, we do get these little dream sequences for them both, right?
Well, I wondered whether this was hypothermia setting in and they were coming closer and closer to death. That was my thought, basically, was when it started to all get a bit weird, was that they were kind of reaching towards the other realm and therefore things were getting a bit freaky.
Well, when she wakes up, right, her lips have gone blue.
We get a cutscene. We'll quickly touch on Rose and Pete. So Rose is there servicing her rifle, as it were, in good knitwear and an apron.
Race on a Friday night.
And then Pete shows up and she says it's going to be one of those nights, isn't it? And then we get Liz and Navarro by the campfire. This is that scene, right? And they start talking about Holden, and Liz has quite an extreme reaction when Navarro says that he spoke to her. I will shoot your sick fucking mouth off your face. I am not merciful. I got no mercy left. She was pretty ferocious, I think, in this moment.
This was my favourite moment of this episode. I actually rewatched it a couple of times because the venom that she's spitting out at Navarro is just fantastic. And she says, you don't know what he said when he was trapped. Was he scared? Was he hurt? Was he screaming, mum? You don't come here and tell me he said, or I will shoot your sick fucking mouth right off your face.
I think for me, I didn't enjoy the writing of this, but I enjoyed their performances. It just felt, this was another moment where they're like, oh, lots of stuff needs to happen by the end of this scene. Let's cram it all in. Because it was a bit of quite a fast 180 that we got out of it, I felt. But as I said, I think the performances were great, though.
Yeah, definitely. And I also loved the line, follow your ghosts, but leave my kid out of it.
Well, this leads on to their big trials by ice, if you like, where Liz gets up, but Navarro's gone. The doors are all open and Navarro has walked out, as she's threatened to do in previous episodes. From her perspective, she's in the desert. We get the distorted wailing and her ears are bleeding. And she meets her mother, who tells her that her name is Sikinachiag.
We've all given Adam a really encouraging thumbs up for that.
I didn't. No, I just want to say, before we get to the mother, yes, you're absolutely right. You've got Navarro. She's in a kind of spiritual place, which for her is a desert. Liz falls through the ice. You know, Jodie Foster absolutely commits to her filming. But Navarro saves her, and Liz asks, what did he say? And Navarro says, Holden says that he sees you. So we're still kind of playing on that. Certainly our main characters, and probably most of Ennis, are on this kind of spiritual plane where they are, I mean, say they are aware, suggests that it's true. I don't mean that at all. But they are connected. They engage with that spiritual connection. And yeah, that's certainly all of the cleaners, but also obviously all of our main characters, including Danvers.
I'll try not to rant too much about this. So we've got her in the desert, and you're right, someone speaks to her and gives her her original name that we know that she's been searching for, she doesn't know. But not only that, she walks towards an overturned vehicle. And I believe that is supposed to represent the RTA that we first talked about in the first episode, where obviously the boy is. My second thing is, isn't it lucky that we had that story about Hank saying that he had to break the ice to bring Peter out of it, because here we were again, an episode later with the same semi-cliched ice story. I think the thing that had a big fuck off again for me was that Evangeline is just not anywhere near her. We see she's very far away, further out towards the water. She's in her own world, whatever it is that she's experiencing, whether it's real, whether it's spiritual, whether it's mental, whether it's hypothermia, whatever. But she is completely engrossed in that world. Yet somehow she's able to snap out of it, run back, and pull Danvers out of that water so quickly.
Yeah, again, some suspension of disbelief may be required here, but I've got two things that I enjoyed about this moment. And one is that I think these are the things that have defined these two characters throughout the series. So for Navarro, it's that pain of not knowing who she was and feeling that she was destined to walk out because that's what her mother had done, that's what her sister had done. And for Liz, it's the pain of having lost a child and the feeling that she let him down. And she's trying to break through the ice to save them. And the second thing that I think is later on in the episode, the Justice Ladies are talking about sending the scientists out into the ice, and she will determine whether or not she wants them or not. And if she doesn't, they'll come back. And the Night Country didn't want Liz and Navarro. They wanted them to come back, and they sent them back.
I back that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And despite Damo's potty mouth, I thought there's elements of that that was really satisfying.
Well, we then get the Traitor style twist and shout version. Again, they're obviously the same sound designers working on the Traitors and Night Country. And then we get Pete breaking the ice and flashing back to Hank breaking the ice for him. So that story does pay off a little bit there. Rose wants him to look away. She doesn't want him to see her cutting the air out of his father's lungs. And then she says, you need to put him in the water yourself, close the door. And she talks about the fact that this, the worst part, he thinks the worst part's done, but it's not. What comes after forever, that's the worst fucking part.
Yeah, I think those two things, what Rose said, close the door and about that's the worst fucking part, for me, just made a lot of this whole series kind of just fall into place a little bit in terms of what they were trying to do. With a lot, and they didn't succeed with all of it at all. But I think I was like, oh, that's what this show is about. I loved that scene and I loved that message. And I just, yeah, thought it was a great, great bit of writing. And yeah, close the door. But not everyone can close the door.
I know I certainly can't close the door on how fantastic Fiona Shaw was.
You used to handle.
The spiritual, metaphorical handle.
She used to handle, the physical handle on the door.
Oh, right. Okay, grand. I shall do that. But yeah, I just think it was a real shame because we hardly saw her and she was brilliant. And it just felt like she was almost like the MacGuffin for this series. How does this thing get solved? Well, don't worry. We'll cut to a short scene where Fiona Shaw explains something kind of parallel to the actual action that will kind of square this all off. Which I just think is a shame because you've got some absolutely phenomenal actresses in this show.
Yeah.
And I thought some of it was a bit cheaply done or just not done as well as it could have been. Mute.
You're on mute.
We skipped over the fact that Navarro telling Liz what Holden said was our fifth question answered, right? Which put me in the driving seat. We only had 20 minutes to go. As long as there weren't any other questions answered, I'm getting another point here. But it's New Year's Day. Happy New Year. And they talk about Clark holding the hatch and how Navarro's felt that way for so long. And that makes Liz suddenly realise that if they use a UV light, they can find the handprints on the hatch. Because he talked about people trying to open the hatch. And they find the handprint and it's missing two fingers.
Just quickly, sorry, because we've gone ahead. I just want to quickly double back. Number one, I got very worried because that duvet was so close to that giant fire. I could see it going up because there's probably polyester in that duvet. I don't think it's eiderdown, so it would probably be a horrible flaming mess. And my other thing was, wasn't it fortunate when they were out burying the bodies that the storm had passed? They had this perfectly clear night. You're not going to believe this. Of all the times to see the Aurora Borealis, after the significant psychological breakthrough.
Firstly, Aurora Borealis, bless you, Damo.
The Northern Lights, should
Thank
I say.
You.
Thank you. Broad appeal here on TVDNA. Yeah, I mean, sure. It was fine, Damo. It's fine.
Really, though?
I just want to quickly, because you know you mentioned about the handprint, obviously, but just before that, we get an insight into actually what happened. So these women are kind of, right, we're seeing the truth of what happened just before that.
That comes a bit later. They find the handprint and we flash to those women. And this was a woman in the very first episode, the first time we saw Navarro, who asked her who her Aka was, right? She's indigenous to the area. She's also the woman who beat a man who beat up on a girl. So kind of the clues were there right from the very beginning, which I loved. She tells Navarro that her name means the return of the sun after the long darkness. That's what that name that I said earlier means.
What was it, Adam? Sorry? No, don't worry.
I just thought it was really fortunate that by chance she would find out what her name is and almost immediately meet someone who also knew someone with the same name.
She finds out what the name means. And when they tell their story, they say that we told ourselves a different story with a different ending. Is that what you would have all preferred?
No, I was totally behind this ending. I fucking love these women. I mean, look, wandering around in your dressing gown, having a cup of tea with your female friends, telling scary stories, is literally my plan for my aging years. This is the commune we all dream of. But I like this ending. I like this twist. I also really want to give a shout out to the kind of, what I would call it, a sort of screaming, wailing drum beat that went underneath the footage of them storming Salal station. I enjoyed that a lot.
I like the twist. I just didn't necessarily enjoy the execution of it, I think, is probably how it was done. Adam is so disgusted by that comment. He's left the Zoom. He was playing a game of musical statues for one for about a minute and a half with a look of complete disbelief and resignation on his face. Hopefully he will return. But yeah, I just think one by one, then walking into the kitchen whilst it was all being discussed. Have more respect for your audience's intelligence. We get this. You don't have to make it so obvious and saccharine. It's great. The local women have had their day. They've dealt with the issue because the official power structure wouldn't do it. Love that. But having them one by one looking kind of like in the mid-distance at them, it just felt a bit cheesy.
I would kind of argue about it being cheesy. I thought it made that narrative very clear because there's lots of parts of the story that haven't been very clear. And so I think as viewers, it made it really clear as to what genuinely happened. They say that, you know, they came up with their own story and then Danvers says, okay, a story's a story. They obviously get off the hook for it. I think it needed to be made clear visually. I'm really glad they did it visually rather than it just being a story.
But we got that, right? We got flashbacks where we saw it all happen bit by bit. So I didn't have an issue with that. That's fine. I get that storytelling. And we, you know, we've had this conversation about who's a reliable narrator, who is unreliable. That all feels clearly very reliable from what we're being told. I think my issue was that as this story was happening and every time we were back in the room where the story was being told, one more person walked into the room and eyeballed them as they went in as if to say, yeah, we did this together. And then it's just, and then another one, and then another. Before you know it, there's 20 people in the kitchen. I think you need to treat your audience with a bit more respect and assume they have a decent level of intelligence that a flashback is enough to give you that information.
And let's face it, too many cooks spoil the broth.
Absolutely. Adam is back. Welcome back, traveller. How was your time on the ice?
It was frosty. It felt very cold and alone.
Oh, welcome home. I just want to give a quick shout out to the line, I guess she ate their fucking dreams from the inside out and spit their frozen bones. Little, you know, you had some sort of fuck off moments, Damo. I had a cheer at that point.
I do think it was great that they were all sort of cleaners and stuff, because clearly they, you know, they did all of this stuff and then just cleaned up after themselves.
What other wisdom do you have to give us, Adam, after your disappearance into the ice?
Well, I assume you've covered the Justice Ladies in my absence. So let's move on to the coda at the end. So we jump forward to May the 12th, the first long day of the year. And Liz is being interviewed and kind of wrapping everything up. Otis was found in Hank's truck, probably a deal gone bad. Hank then suffered an accident. And isn't it odd that Clark died in the same way as the Salal men? Yeah, it's odd, isn't it?
Odd things happen.
Really, though? What I really loved about this was that opened from the view of seeing her being interviewed on the screen of the video camera. So it was another reference to season one. Time is a flat circle. She was doing her best Rustin Cole impression, I guess, in that moment.
I did like kind of seeing the change in Danvers, I guess, from Danvers in episode one and then now. I felt like it was just sort of summed up in her going, well, some questions just don't have answers. And I feel
you're absolutely right. And I was about to say that. Adam, what questions have been answered? Because some just don't have answers.
Well, the sixth question that we did have answered was, why did the scientists go out on the ice? And so that meant that I didn't score a point from this episode. But it does finish the series with the only point scorer and therefore the ultimate winner of True Detective Night Country. But let's get on to the burning question of the end of the episode. What happened to Navarro? Is she alive or is she dead?
I think she's dead. I'm going to really back myself here. I think she's dead. I think she did what she always said she would do, what she felt very at peace doing, walked out. But I think that, you know, her appearing next to Danvers at the end just for me means they just haven't closed the door on each other.
Yeah, I think if she was alive, she'd probably be with Kavik, right? She'd have settled down with the man with the best moonshine in Ennis. But she doesn't. We see her kind of, as you said, she's not in the car when Danvers and her daughter drive to this remote cabin. We just see her not even next to her. She just walks in. She's a presence rather than physically, well, not physically, but, you know, rather than actually being there. I'm in agreement that is the spirit world, for want of a better word.
Yeah. And obviously, before she goes, she returns Kavik's toothbrush to him. It was his favourite toothbrush, but is he going to use it again? She also leaves a polar bear toy on her bed, and underneath it, the phone with the recording of Clark telling the truth about Silver Sky, which then gets leaked. But Liz doesn't know how it got leaked, obviously. We get a little shot of Pete with his son and Leah and Liz getting on, and the line, "This is Ennis. Nobody ever really leaves."
Yeah, just quickly for Pete. So obviously he's fucked. He's completely fucked. I mean, the one thing is, obviously, he is desperate to not make the mistakes his father made with him, but he's fucked and he will always be fucked.
There is a line earlier on when Navarro is talking to Liz and she says, "Pryor is fucked forever now, right?"
Oh yeah, that was a good line. Yeah, I think that's definitely what we saw there. But he's back in his home with his family because apparently his wife just really loves it when someone's got something to do.
I'm genuinely surprised that he made it through alive. Now, I thought he would be sacrificed, certainly on a plot and out level. But yeah, I guess what's the worst torture but to live with a history like that?
He's in the worst fucking part.
I don't think Ennis is that bad.
Okay, sorry, just quickly before we finish this record, because I've been meaning to... Why would anyone live in Ennis? I mean, other than unless you have a sort of heritage there and it's your indigenous land, why would anyone choose to live there?
Maybe you don't have a choice. Financial and emotional ties can really keep you in a certain location.
I think also it's just kind of what they're trying to explain, also that it's a kind of a black hole. And that once you're in its orbit, it's almost impossible to leave.
Some people come to Alaska to escape. And on that note, should we summarise? So, Damo, I'm guessing this isn't going to be in your top 10 shows of the year. But where, for you, does this sit in the True Detective pantheon?
Better than two. Not better than three, I think. just because I think three is solid throughout. Whereas for me, this season started off really well. I was so invested and I mean, how long have we been talking about this? We've been talking about this on the pod for so long. And I love Jodie Foster and I wanted it to be so good. So yeah, it's got to go third, I'm afraid. Better than season two, but not better than season three. Obviously season one at the top.
I really enjoyed the show overall. I think this is one of the best things I've seen this year. And I did enjoy the mystery of it, the kind of the suspense and the mixture of potential supernatural stuff. I think beautiful setting. And most of it was shot in Iceland because the places in Alaska they need to shoot, you can't actually get to. But I just, yeah, the sort of the setting of it, the fact that it was permanent night and the performances, I think it was a stunning show. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting about it. How about you guys?
Yeah, it's been lush. Been totally lush to chat about it. It's been very helpful, actually, because, you know, at the end of every episode, a lot of the time I'm going, what is happening? So it's quite handy to have a chat about it.
Yeah, definitely. I don't expect it to win any awards. And I completely agree with Damo that season one of True Detective, it will be extremely hard to better. But I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it enough to keep watching. So much so that I wanted to talk about it, even though I don't really want to spend time with you guys. So it definitely had a bonus to that. Obviously, that's a joke.
Two things just to add to that. Number one, I know it's not easy, but if you are able to, I would highly recommend going to Iceland if you can. It is phenomenal. And second of all, the other thing for me out of this series is I would be very interested to see what Callie Reese does next. And I would be very much interested in watching whatever her next project is because, I mean, this was her first proper go and I thought she was brilliant.
100%.
Completely agree.
Brand, well, as the winner of True Detective Night Country, I guess it falls on me to say, let us know what you thought of the finale on the social media at TVDNAPod or email TVDNAPod@gmail.com. We will be back with another special show soon. We're going to do a watch list episode and we've got our Hooniversity challenges still to come. But thank you very much for listening through. I know we've had a lot of listeners for True Detective and we hope you've enjoyed us talking about it. Any final lines that anyone wants to give us?
I think all we can say is cases closed. Happy New Year.